And then I said to them, does that mean that I can put monkeys in my book? And there was this, and there was this long pause, and one of them goes, sure. He's just like, is this what you wanted? You just want to put monkeys in your book.
Welcome to In the Weeds with Nicole Asquith, exploring the way culture shapes our relationship to the natural world. This is the second of my episodes on the apocalyptic. I had the idea for this series back when I started In the Weeds. I wondered, were zombies a coping mechanism for climate change? And that was before things got all, well, apocalyptic. In the first of this series, episode 18, I talked to the theologian Bernard McGinn about the origins of apocalypticism. Going back to Jewish literature and the very beginning of Christianity, Jesus, it turns out, preached the end of days himself. In this episode, I talked to journalist and author Brian Francis Slattery about his apocalyptic novel, Lost Everything, which won the 2012 Philip K. Dick Award. Set in the Northeast in a fictional not-too-distant future, it focuses on two friends and allies, Reverend Bauxite and Sunny Jim, who are making their way up the Susquehanna River in search of Sunny Jim's son. Jim feels pulled apart by the two great loves of his life, his son, who has been left up north in the care of Jim's sister, and his wife Aline, who was last seen blowing up a bridge for the resistance. Meanwhile, there are rumors of a storm of unthinkable size, referred to simply as the Big One. This slice of New York and Pennsylvania has been transformed by climate change and civil war. The banks of the Susquehanna River have overflowed, engulfing towns and breaking dams. Though the landscape has familiar elements of post-industrial detritus, it has changed into a tropical wasteland of sorts. Here's a little excerpt to give you a taste. That night, they hid in the last building standing on the block of Pfeffer and North 7th, a red brick house that used to lean on its neighbors, but had nothing to lean on now. The stairs falling off the porch, window frames angling with rain and gravity, a kitchen half gutted by rot, a gas stove with no gas. Across North 7th, the railroad tracks were torn up in 12 places. They could see the remains of the Capitol from the roof burned down again. They drew the place where the building's dome had been in the air with their fingers. They listened to the howling of monkeys in the houses near them. Sirens from the other side of the bridge. There were alarms all over the city that night. Neither of them knew why. Needless to say, Brian and I spoke remotely. In these coronavirus times, there are certain challenges, as you may know, to working from home. My husband's on an important work call. My daughter is Zooming. My son is, I think, playing video games, but going rogue. And my puppy is currently chewing a piece of paper.
Oh, excellent.
I managed to keep the children at bay, but occasionally you'll hear my puppy crying for attention. Brian and I talked about his novel and later about the apocalyptic in popular culture, what he likes and doesn't like.
It's one of the reasons I kind of stopped watching the Marvel movies. You know, it's just like, this is all getting a little too, oh, the world is going to end.
And what he thinks the apocalyptic might do for us. So how are you doing? How is this quarantine treating you?
Oh, good. Fine, actually. Yeah, we're among the people who can't really complain. Both my wife and I are still working. My wife's a pediatrician and I'm a journalist. So we fall into that category of essential personnel, though she's much more essential than I am.
It must be tricky for her. Is she seeing patients or is she mostly trying to treat people remotely?
Oh my God. It's the whole thing is like a mess. She has all of the problems that every other small business I've talked to as a journalist has. You know, they're trying to figure out how to balance like the need to keep safe with the need to stay afloat as a business. And it's not easy. There's, you know, just complications upon complications.
Goodness.
But you know, we're doing okay.
Good. I'm glad.
Yeah, our problems are not unique.
And you guys are in Connecticut, right?
Yeah, we're in Hamden. It's just north of New Haven.
So I want to talk to you about your book, Lost Everything.
Yeah, sure.
Which I had started reading a while back, But then I had been interrupted a number of times, so I decided to start again from the beginning, which I think was a good choice. No, it was good because, well, for one thing, you know how it is. Like the second time around, certain passages make a lot more sense. And like, you know what's being foreshadowed a little bit. Also, it's a book that really benefits from a concentrated read, I think.
Oh, thanks.
From that kind of soaking sort of into the intent. I have to say, at the beginning of the whole epidemic,
it's a little on the nose right now, isn't it?
Yeah. So I was introduced to you through my friend Cameron, and I was talking to her about the fact that what I've been planning for some time now to do a series on the apocalyptic. You know, it's not a genre that I'm particularly steeped in myself, but it's impossible not to notice in popular culture and kind of all over the places
how prevalent
it is. And I've had this curiosity about what the genre expresses about our anxieties, you know, our feelings about what's happening to the world right now.
Yeah.
So this is your only book that I've read so far, although I'm curious to read your other novels, but I gather that they are also somewhat in an apocalyptic genre. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. I mean, so what happened was the first three books that I wrote are all kind of like that. And it's a pretty natural progression because it was like, I finished the first book and kind of had like questions left over. And then finished the second one, it was sort of the same thing. Like there were kind of questions left over. And then at the end of the third one, I was like, okay, I'm done with this. Like I've taken this about as far as I can take it. And so there's definitely some differences. The first two books are funnier for starters. They're a little bit more like rompy, I guess. And the third one was that I think that the questions that were left at the end of the second one were all just like much more serious than they had been. And yeah, so I thought, okay, like I kind of got to get this like out of my system or, you know, I'm going to be writing about this for the rest of my life. And I kind of don't want to be like, I started thinking of it as like, this is such a dumb analogy, but I really did think of it as like when you're finishing a melon and you're kind of like down to the end where you're like scraping against the rind. That's how the third book felt. And so
I like that,
you know, so it was kind of like, okay, I'm done.
I was going to ask you about the narrator,
who I found to be
one of the more interesting aspects of your book. And that was one of the things I benefited from starting over again with, because this voice gets introduced in this kind of sneaky way. And I think the first read, I didn't realize,
the narrator's like technically somebody who's actually in that world.
Right.
Yeah.
And consequently, the reader is also somebody who's in that world, right? Because you're being addressed as somebody whom she meets later on in the narrative. So sort of an open-ended question. What made you choose that kind of a narrator?
The biggest reason for it was that a lot of the impulse for the book was to sort of get at the question, what if you really don't know what's going to happen? And being a kind of literal person, I thought, well, that does away with the idea of there being like an omniscient narrator. There's so much in the book about like what happens when that storm comes. Do we have a chance of surviving this thing or not? If we survive the storm, what does it even look like after that? And I realized that this whole book was really about like, what do you do when there's this just giant question mark sitting in front of you that in a sort of short-term way, that's like, you know, within a year, we're going to be confronting this question mark. And it struck me that if I had like an omniscient narrator, then like it's a little bit cheating because it's like, well, if the omniscient narrator knows what's going to happen, then there can't really be any tension. So I put the narrator in the world. And as soon as I did that, it was kind of one thing led to another where you sort of go, okay, now that the narrator is in the world, I have to even think about how much time I picture the narrator like. Not necessarily writing the book. I mean, that was a little too weird. But I did picture the narrator having to be able to collect the information that the narrator could collect in the amount of time that I like that you said she. I've actually never really decided.
Did I say she? It's funny. I think I assumed it was a she for some reason. Although
I like that assumption. And I understand why. Did I?
Well, I don't know. Or maybe you just revealed some of my inherent sexism because...
Oh, no, not at all. I don't remember ever deciding.
No, no, but I wasn't thinking just about the narrator, but it just in general, you often introduce characters by their title or yes. by their function. And then you wait to reveal their gender, which is interesting because yes. I found myself a couple of times assuming it was a man and then discovering it was a woman.
Right.
Thinking, oh, I shouldn't have.
That was all. Yeah. That's cool. I mean, actually, I'm glad that came across. I definitely remember that being intentional. It's like a world's like mostly populated by women. Mm-hmm. But this is like a total tangent. But that's from while I was writing that book in particular, before I became like this local arts journalist person that I am now. I did a lot of editing for public policy publications about international affairs, and a lot of them were about conflicts around the world. Fascinating / very depressing topic. You know, one of the things that comes across in a lot of that literature is that like at the end of a protracted war, the men are either dead or incapacitated because they've all fought. And so the people who are left for a time, there's a kind of big skew towards women are like the only people who can do work, you know, for a while afterward. So it's one of those things that I felt like, well, I should represent that reality. And it also coincided with my desire to put people a little bit off their guard about, you know, like what they, because I agree with you. Like when I read books, I mean, I'm a 45-year-old person and I suffer from the same thing of like defaulting to men. And it was really fun to write a book where it's like, I can't default to men. It doesn't make sense to do that.
It did seem like it said something about the world that you created too somehow.
Yeah.
In the sense that, you know, people's jobs, people's relationships, a lot of them are defined by the fallout of the chaos that yeah. they're living in.
Yeah, right? For sure. Yeah, definitely. And I mean, and a lot of those things are drawn from, you know, things that I learned on my day job. There's a lot of stuff in the book that's a little bit too close to like journalism. In some ways, it's not surprising that I am now actually a journalist. I think that with each book I wrote, I kind of wanted to hew closer and closer to reality. You know, even if it was kind of a collage of a couple different scenarios, which this one was. You know, including the sort of things, even the things about how, like, you know, nature tends to come back after a conflict because man-made activity kind of, you know, grinds to a halt. I mean, a little bit like what we're seeing now.
Yeah, you know, like definitely even, like what we're seeing now.
Yeah, like even like that, those kinds of ideas, like those are all things I remember pulling from the things I was reading for work.
Mm,
yeah,
that's interesting. Can you give an example of where you saw that in real life?
So the best single thing is probably that I took a lot from reportage about the wars in Central Africa. You know, there are places that were like not particularly heavily governed to begin with. And then when the wars started, whatever governmental structures were there became even weaker. Things just start to erode. Things like roads start to disappear. When a bridge gets bombed, it doesn't get rebuilt. You know, that kind of stuff. And that was true of that place. And it was also true of, I happened to go to Guatemala in 2002, which would have been like 6 years after the civil war there ended. And there was definitely like a lot of that going on, you know, that it was just that something had happened during the conflict and like, you know, like something like that, like a piece of infrastructure had been destroyed. Mm-hmm. Or it had just fallen apart from neglect because, you know, during a war, nobody's building roads. You know, like whatever it is they built like 30 years ago is whatever it is that they have at the end of it. And whatever shape it's in is whatever shape it's in. I remember like being there, seeing like countless examples of like if a bridge was, for some reason, these things are all about bridges. But like a bridge is a great example of like a thing that's kind of hard to build on your own. Right? So like, there'd be some bridges that you would go over where you could tell that the people around had rebuilt the bridge. They needed it, you know, and it wasn't that big a deal to build it. So they just built it. And it's this kind of like quasi-rickety wooden bridge. You know, you probably shouldn't drive a car over it, but you could like, you know, people could walk over it. And then like, there'd be other places where there's like an overpass that fell down, like a highway overpass. And it's like, no one's going to rebuild that. You know, it's like if the government doesn't rebuild it, then it doesn't get rebuilt.
And then people just learn how to deal with the fact that like the highway's broken. That's it. You know, like that's your new reality until the government figures out how to build highways again.
So let's talk a little bit about the menaces that face the characters in your book.
Sure.
The two that loom the largest to me are war and
the impending storm.
Yeah. but there's also the implication that something like climate change has happened.
Yes.
Snow no longer exists.
Right.
There are animals like monkeys that normally wouldn't inhabit the northeast of the United States that are suddenly common. So was that connection to climate change?
Oh, for sure.
Explicit. Okay. Yes. I figured it was, but
yeah.
So talk to me a little bit about that.
Yeah. I mean, this is another good example of like, so at the time when I was writing it, I did want to make this kind of explicit thing that, you know, the climate will have changed. I dug up like a report from, I'm struggling to remember exactly what government agency it was, but it was a government agency. It's probably associated with like the Department of the Interior that somebody decided that they were going to make a couple of speculations as to how the climate might change across the United States. And like the way that this report was written, they kind of had four or five different scenarios. And one of them was that the Northeast would just become like almost tropical. There was a scenario where it's like, these, you know, if the model goes this way, it gets hotter and it gets wetter. So you get this kind of like quasi-tropical environment going on. And I have a couple of friends who are, you know, like biologists. They're oceanographers, but they're just, yeah, they're just good biologists. And I made them go on a canoe trip with me down the Susquehanna River. And
oh, wow.
Yeah, it was super fun, like a super fun trip. And like while I was there, like I'm talking about the things I had looked up and how. Now, the other thing is that so it's as it turns out, like the Susquehanna River is itself, most of the details about the Susquehanna River are things that are there now or were there 10 years ago. There really are sort of like the ruins of bridges and, you know, the, all these like overgrown things. You know, it's one of those like post-industrial areas where there used to be a lot more activity than there is now. So there's a lot of just like stuff lying around on the riverbanks that, you know, that people don't use anymore. I remember like looking, like telling them about this report and saying like, hey, you know, does it strike you as plausible that this place could become kind of tropical? And both of them were like, yeah, like that's one way that this could work out. And then I said to them, does that mean that I can put monkeys in my book? And there was this, and there was this long pause, and one of them goes, sure. He's just like, is this what you wanted? You just want to put monkeys in your book, don't you? But I kind of did just want to put monkeys in the book. Because I think of it as like monkeys are one of those great sort of like shorthand for like a lot of things have changed. If you have monkeys, then it means that, you know, 50 other things have happened. That is the reason that they've migrated up from Central America, which is about as far north as they get right now.
Yeah, and you'd mentioned Guatemala. So in some sense, it's like we become like Guatemala here in the Northeast.
I was definitely doing that. Yeah.
I was thinking about the ruins of the Mayan temples in Guatemala, too.
Yes.
And the way you see the monkeys crawl over them. And so in some way, it would be like the equivalent of that, only of what we think of as our sort of industrial or post-industrial landscape.
Yeah. I mean, there's a fair amount of me trying to be like, I don't think it's cool to like destroy a place, even in fiction. Like it's not something that I enjoy doing. And I think that it's one of those like problems I sometimes have with other post-apocalyptic fiction that it's just like, you're enjoying this a little too much. I think it's actually kind of bad when these things happen. So in some ways I was trying to be respectful toward, you know, like I wanted it to feel more real and more like real places for that matter.
Well, and your own places too, in a sense, right? I mean, I don't know how familiar you are with these particular towns, but if you're destroying somebody else's town.
Totally. Well, also,
it's a little different somehow.
Yeah. And for what it's worth, I grew up in Ithaca, New York, which is pretty close. Like the town where Jim and his sister grow up is like 20 minutes away from my house where I grew up. And I was definitely trying to be like quite respectful of that. This all got lost, of course, in the course of writing this thing. But like at the beginning of it, there was a part of me that was like, I want to write a book about the place where I grew up, which when I was growing up was kind of
and still kind of is. It's like it was a place that was kind of like winding down. It's like losing population. And there are a lot of places that were like losing population. There's like abandoned houses and abandoned farms. And I was always kind of taken aback by like how unnoticed that was. People know like nothing about those places, you know, and I kind of wanted to be accurate about it. I mean, it's so weird. It's so weird because I made so much up. Like, I understand like how contradictory this all is, you know, but like in the sort of like the details of it, I really was kind of like so many of the details in that book are things that I got from just, I did the path that that the book takes. And I just sat there with like a notebook and a camera. And, you know, when I couldn't be on the river, I would be like driving alongside it. And I just took like a ton of pictures and a ton of notes. And like so much of that ended up in the book.
Mm.
You know?
No, I get that feeling. There's a kind of loving relationship to these destroyed landscapes, which gives it, I'm very sensitive to what feels like a somewhat gratuitous.
Yeah, me too.
Violence, you know? Me too. And although it was painful at times, for sure, it didn't give me that feeling.
For sure. There are people who have read some things that I've written and they're just like, your depictions of violence are awful, you know? And I'm just like, yeah, they should be. They should hurt. If you're going to write about something violent, like it's bad, you know? I don't like writing about violence where you're then encouraged to like root for somebody. I always think of it as, you know, even when it's done for like a reason that you can justify morally, like the act itself is still violence after all.
Right.
You know, and is going to affect the victim and the perpetrator, you know, in all kinds of ways.
I wanted to ask you about the river and your choice of the river is almost a protagonist. I mean, very much so, I would say, in the story. What inspired that?
Well, I mean, part of it was the having decided to write about the region. It's like the biggest river in the region that isn't the Hudson. And I didn't want to write about the Hudson Valley because it's a whole other thing over there. So I was kind of, it was almost like I was sort of like stuck with the Susquehanna River. And one of the things that was kind of cool about it is that like the Susquehanna River is like not, you couldn't actually put a boat up the Susquehanna River. Like it's like 4 feet deep almost everywhere. It's really, really shallow. And it's dammed in like seven different places, even between like Harrisburg and Binghamton. There were a lot of things I had to change to make the book plausible. Part of that was kind of fun, you know, where you're like, well, I have to like get rid of all the dams and I have to get rid of, I have to make it deeper. I have to, there's all kinds of things to change. And it was, you know, it struck me as like highly convenient that I had set this in the future because I was allowed to do things like that. Because like, you know, the first thing, I remember like getting a couple of books about the history of the Susquehanna River, which as you can imagine is not like the most interesting read ever. But, you know, at the time was like exactly what I needed. A couple of them, I would open it up and the first thing would say, it's a real disappointment that you can't put a boat up it. And I'm like, really? it's really inconvenient for what I'm trying to do here. For me, one of the things that was interesting about it is that it's a place where I grew up. And also when I was growing up there, felt very apart. Like both my parents were like transplants to that area. And there are people who, you know, where their families had been there forever. And they were living like a completely different existence from what I was living. You know, when I was growing up there, like when I'd meet people who were like that, whose families had been there for a while and who were like the sons and daughters of like factory workers where the factory had closed down. And they were just living a very different reality from me. And in some ways, I was always very grateful that I had grown up at a place like that, because when I left it, I didn't meet people like that for a long time. Mm-hmm. Like I went, you go to college, you go to grad school, you live in New York. Like these people are like so far away at that point. And it really kind of hit me, especially living in New York, where people would make these very like blanket statements about people who lived in rural areas, that I would be like, yeah, that's not fair. You know, it's not what it's not what their lives are like. And it's not what, you know, they, you know, there are reasons why they do the things they do that really kind of escape people who have never met anyone who's grown up on a farm. And
sure.
Yeah. You know, that's something that I kind of wanted to get out, you know, and even to the point of view where like the narrator's voice isn't mine. The narrator's voice is a friend of mine in high school,
you know, who actually spoke in that kind of oddly like elliptical clipped sort of way. Like he would give you just enough information to get through the conversation you were talking about. He would do that all the day. He would like leave out verbs, you know, if he didn't need to say what had happened and he just needed to tell you a noun, he would just tell you the noun. His voice like always stuck with me as an interesting way of talking. And it seems to fit really well with the theme of this book where there's, again, there's this giant question mark, you know, this threat that nobody really knows much about. I started to think of it as like a place where like language fails, like it's really hard to even describe what the heck is coming. And it made sense that a person who is like clipping words out of their sentences is also talking about something that's hard to describe. That all sort of fed back on itself. Like once I got in the hang of writing that way, the rest of the book got really easy to write. And then it got very hard to write, you know, in a more normal way afterward. I had to like unlearn how to write in this oddly elliptical style. I was probably difficult to live with during that period. If I, God help me if I talked like that, you know, while I was writing it. It's like, are you going to the store today? And it'd be like, store? It's just, oh my God, stop. Keep going.
Well, I want to get to the big one, but before we get there, I wanted to stick a little bit with the river and with the boat.
Sure.
So I'm going to read a little passage. The boat has very much a feel like the ark, like Noah's ark.
Yeah, for sure.
So let me read this. This is one of the first descriptions. On the deck of the Carthage, the crew were lighting more lanterns and candles, animals everywhere, horses, camels, a cow and three ponies suspended in the air in harnesses screaming, a troop of monkeys occupying the bow, a llama easing itself into slumber even as the humans clambered around it, shouting, hauling trunks across the wood. So tell me, was the arc aspect deliberate and how does that fit into the narrative?
Yeah, definitely. Super deliberate. So another sort of like fun long story short here was that I have a friend who's an Episcopal priest. He almost deserves like co-authorship for this book. You know, when I decided that there'd be like these two characters, I wanted one of them to be a secular agnostic-y sort of person. And I wanted somebody else to have like some real faith. And I don't have real faith, but I do have this friend who does. And I talked to him for hours to be like, so if you were in this position, like what would you do and how would you view this through like the lens of a, you know, of a faithful Christian person? Because part of what I was interested in was this idea of like, if you don't know what the future is, for a secular agnostic person, that's like a pretty tough road to hoe, mentally speaking. And for someone of faith, it's actually, in some ways, it's a little bit easier to handle. You're sort of used to thinking that way. There's things you don't understand, you know, you don't know what's going to happen, but there's like a kernel of strength in there of like, well, whatever happens, like if I'm a good person, things will turn out okay for me, you know? And like, I was always intrigued. Part of me was intrigued by this because he wasn't the first person that I'd met where I think like, you know, this person's faith is a real source of strength to them in this really awful time. So I took great pains to like have it be that if you are a secular person, you read this book in one way. And if you are a devoutly Christian person, you can read this book in a whole other way. And it's like it has this pretty strong thread, which my priestly friend says I succeeded in doing. You know, that he's just like, this really can be read as this like enormous allegory about faith and about specifically Christian faith. And, you know, what it means to like wrestle with these questions about faith and morality and what it means to be a good Christian in a time of crisis and all of those things. And like, that was all like pretty important to me. I really wanted that the book to work in that way.
Why?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. This is one of those things, like the more I talk about it, I'm like, why did I make this so hard?
No, you know? I mean, I'm intrigued.
So I think part of it was that I felt that in the United States, there is sometimes this real cultural divide between the religious people and not religious people. And I'm one of these people where I know many of both. And
I would hear things from non-religious people that would irritate me, especially in the political realm. There's often this undercurrent of, you know, you go to church because like you don't believe in science or something. Like there's these weird trade-offs that they're making. And I always felt like that was a little bit unfair. One of the things that Reverend Bauxite does is that he acts. He doesn't tend to like worry that much, you know, in a way that some of the other characters do. For him, his faith is a call to action almost every time. Mm-hmm. To me, that was an interesting character because he's really not like me. You know, he's in some ways he's the sort of person that I would like to think that I would be. Mm-hmm. But he's, you know, I liked having that character who kind of played against some people's preconceptions of what a religious person is like.
I feel like the other thing that the religious dimension allows you to do is to speak to kind of the spiritual crisis of
yes.
whether we're Christian or not Christian. It makes totally. Me think of, I did an episode on the Pope's encyclical on the environment, mm-hmm. and the Pope kind of brings lots of threads together.
Yeah.
But one of the things that he speaks to is the spiritual pain, you know, and also this sense yeah. of sin, which I think is, you know, is something I guess that is evolving in the Catholic tradition, depending on.
Totally.
I spoke with Christiana Zenner, a professor I talked to about this, talked about how there's increasingly this notion of sort of institutional sin, you know, that
yeah.
there are these societal institutions that are allowing poverty and
for sure.
environmental degradation and so on to mm-hmm. to take place. And so that I thought was a very interesting part.
Yeah. I mean, I think that was part of it for me too. Like when you look at sort of just the tone of a lot of the conversation about climate change, it's really hard to escape that sort of general vibe of like we have sinned and we must atone for our sins, you know. Mm-hmm. Like it's, we use slightly different nouns, but the tone is so similar, you know. It's this idea of like we've made so many mistakes, we messed this whole thing up, you know, and like now we have to fix it, we have to put it all back together again. Like that's so Christian.
Absolutely. That and idea. It's so baked into American culture.
Yeah And even in like the reckoning with the racism of our past also feels that way to me. It's this sense of like there's 400 years of sin. We have to atone for it in some way.
So one of the darker sides of your book is that climate change and the devastation that it wreaks on all sorts of aspects of this society then ultimately leads to war. Mm-hmm. And the narrator sort of explains that people don't even quite understand what caused the war.
Yeah.
You know, that it was a number of things that were almost accidental in nature. Mm-hmm. So are you doing that as a kind of prediction of sorts, or, you know, if this is what might happen, or what made you choose that part of the book?
I think part of it was that I wanted to avoid writing a book where I was going to lay out like the future history of the United States. No, it wasn't fair really enough. What I was interested in doing. You know, it's like I don't tend to love books like that where it's like, well, then if this happens, and it starts to feel like a little bit of like a Rube Goldberg machine. Like I was much more interested in the psychological state of like being where those characters were. That was also something that I pulled out of something I had read for my day job. So many of the wars in the second half of the 20th century lasted for like two generations. So there were people where like they were born and the war had already started. Like the war had been going on for 15 years at that point. For those people who were born into those circumstances, the questions of like why the war started, they'd be like, why do you care? You know, it'd be like, you know, why does the sun rise? It's like, what kind of question is that? And like, what good is it going to do you now to solve that problem? You know, it was like 15 years ago. Knowing the cause of it is not going to help you toward fixing it. You know, it's not going to help you survive it either. To me, that was a bit of an awakening because I think that there's a sense that people have sometimes where it's like, well, if we can just understand how this problem started, then we can fix it. And you sort of go like, well, you know, there are some problems that are not like that. You know,
there are problems where, you know, the source is just so far in the past and things have changed so much since then that it's just like time to move on from that. That's one of the things that has actually kind of stuck with me since writing that book. I think I was one of those people, you know, who is thinking more like that. You know, if you can just figure out how it started, we can fix it.
So then the big one is the other looming menace in the story. So what was the motivation behind that?
It's funny because like in the first draft of the book, speaking of like making things really difficult for myself, when I told you before that I thought of like that problem is like it's a place where like language itself kind of starts to fail. I literally had this thing where if a character saw it, they wouldn't be able to describe it. So it just sat out there as like this completely undefined thing. And you know, Cameron, my agent read it and she was just like, dude, this is like really, really hard because you can't describe this thing. And the editor, like my editor, Liz Gorinsky, said the same thing. She's like, there's got to be a way to make this more concrete. It wasn't that I was resistant to what they were saying. It was that for a while, I didn't really know quite how to attach that idea to the rest of the book. And it turned out that, you know, the more I thought about it, the more I figured out that the climate change angle is the way to do it. You know, where there's just this thing that looks like a big storm. You know, it's really, really, really big. You know, it's also one of those things where you like you wave your hands a little bit. I didn't want it to be that it was totally explainable. It was pretty important to me that it's not like, well, we can just get a satellite image of this thing and figure out how big it is. You know, and then we'll know how long it's probably going to stick around. We'll know, you know, we'll be able to predict all kinds of things about it. Like it was really important to me that the people in the book not be able to get any information about it. So we could kind of stay as this existential threat. You just don't know how bad it's going to be. you know that it's going to be bad. You don't know how bad. And you don't know if you're going to survive it. And you don't know what's going to be left when it's over. I remember at the time thinking that this all felt a little too unrealistic. It just didn't seem like I could like make the concepts pass the smell tests, you know, for plausibility. But I think that recent history has proved me wrong. It would have been a much easier thing to do now because we see what it's like when a storm like that passes over, like, and it can totally engulf a place. I was thinking about that a lot when Hurricane Maria hit Puerto Rico, and you think like, you know, for a week, we didn't know what was going on that island. Yeah, and the people on the island didn't know what was going on here. You know, it was just totally cut off. There's a pretty strong Puerto Rican population here in New Haven. The place where I work is connected to a Spanish language newspaper. And there really was like for a few days, they'd just be like, I have relatives there and I have no idea how they are. Like, I don't know where they are. I don't know if they're okay. As the days went by, like those connections got reestablished. But there was an awfully long time for, you know, the present day, you know, that we really didn't know anything about what was happening. And to some extent, like we kind of still don't. I feel like that's a story that's going to take years to put back together again.
So you use the expression existential threat, and that expression was on my lips at the very moment that you used it. So I feel like there's a way in which the big one serves as a kind of shorthand for the part of climate change and honestly other potential existential threats, you know, nuclear war and so on, are a part of our reality now.
Yeah, like problems that are too big to fix.
Right, and too big to grasp in a sense, you know? It's like we can say the words, but our mental capacity is not quite up to the task of understanding what that would mean. And that maybe that gets to the inability to describe or articulate.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I was sort of stubbornly trying to cling to in the first couple drafts of it, is that like we can't even comprehend the size of this problem, you know?
But yeah. So I think that part of what you're book does is to speak to what that means for our psyche. So my question is, do you feel like writing a novel like this, you know, you said that you felt like you'd gotten something out of your system. You used the analogy of like getting down to the rind.
Yeah.
Do you feel like writing a book like this helps you in some way to deal with the kind of emotional and psychological burden of our reality?
It
it did for me. I like
not I, for your readers.
I, you know, I'd like to think that if it worked for me, it would work for other people. You know, for somebody who wrote such a sort of sad and, you know, relentlessly gray book, I actually like don't tend to like books like that. And the more that I am made to feel bad, the more I want there to be a reason that I'm being made to feel that way. And that was something that I wrestled with while I was writing it myself. Like, there are certain things that I think of as like completely worth the tension and the, like the movie Children of Men. I love that movie. It's dark and it's relentless, but I feel like the payoffs are like enormous in that movie. But it feels kind of like shooting the moon, you know, in Hearts. It's like it gets worse and worse and worse. And then there's like something that pops out at the end that makes you go like, oh, and that's why. And that's the sort of thing that I was trying to create, you know, and I think that like, it's one of those books where when somebody tells me that they hate it, I'm like, dude, I totally get it. Like, it's not like, it's not fun. It is not a fun book.
Right.
Like, yeah. Yes, there's no question about it. But then like there are people that really like it and they like it for the same reasons that I feel like I wrote it. And that is very gratifying. And it feels like, you know, like I knew what I was getting myself into, I guess, when I was writing this thing. It's like, well, you're going to lose a lot of people who are like, where are all the jokes you used to make? And you're like, yeah, this isn't that kind of book. I remember like doing my best to make the first paragraph just be like, if you're expecting this book to be funny, like it's just not going to be. it's like this first paragraph is like kind of what the book is going to be like. You're either down with this or you're not, and if you're not, then like go find something else to read. There's a million other things, you know, but maybe there's something about this first paragraph that makes you say like, okay, this is the right time and the right place for me to be reading this thing. And that was, you know, that was more or less what I was going for. But I think in my case it did help. Since I wrote it, I mean, it's now been like quite a while, yeah, since I wrote it, you know, a decade. I've become a little bit impatient with the kind of doom and gloom rhetoric attached to climate change issues. I think to myself, we already were talking about it like that, like 10 years ago. Like, we have to find some other new way of talking about it. That's much harder.
So I want to ask you a question that I had earlier. You were talking about your motivation for writing this kind of book. And I was wondering how you feel about more sort of popular culture forms of apocalypticism or post-apocalyptic things, you know, everything from zombies to,
yeah.
I mean, do you enjoy stuff like that? Or is there a part of you that feels sort of frustrated or impatient with it? I have this sort of nagging question of like, what does that do? What does that say about where we are? And
oh, totally. Know. No, I know what you mean. Like, it's, then like the motivations for like making that stuff and also consuming it are like super questionable, you know, in a lot
but
of ways.
But interesting, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's interesting because
hey,
I feel
I'm like
it
I'm
betrays.
Right there.
Okay,
like,
good.
No, absolutely. Like, I think like that's something that like while I was making things like that, I would really be questioning like why am I, you know, what is it saying about me that I'm into this? Like, on some level, it's like, you know, I spent years of my life writing about these kinds of things. And you're like, God, what is it saying that I did that? And, you know, what does it say when people enjoy it? Yes, there are all kinds of unpleasant and questionable things going on there. And so my feelings about them are, I do think it's possible to do it badly. Like, if it's just sort of done for entertainment, the more shallow it is, the less I like it. It's one of the reasons I kind of stopped watching the Marvel movies. You know, it's just like, this is all getting a little too like, oh, the world is going to end. It's a very easy way to ramp up the stakes and make it feel like super important. And it's a good way to like trivialize some things that are really a big deal. But on the other hand, there's a bunch of things that I really, really like. I think that there's a place for catharsis in all of this. And there's a place for like going through the mental gymnastics of how to survive something like that and how to sort of be resilient and those kinds of questions, which I think are like super valid. Like the thing that I would bring up most recently would be, I haven't watched the TV show and don't really need to at this point, but I plowed through the entire Walking Dead series, the comic, and I love that thing. I think it's really, really good.
And it's like, it's not an easy read. It's not, you know, it's not fun. You know, it's really tense a lot, and some really, really horrible things happen. There's a lot of like questions about what it means to be human, basically, that I think go pretty deep. And they go deep in a really fast and powerful way. Like, I actually read it like with my son because he was into it. And I started reading it because I was at first worried. I was just like, is he like old enough to read this thing? But then like the more we talked about it, I was just like, this is great. Like, this book is really powerful and quite beautiful at the end. And this it's weird to use the word beautiful to describe anything in The Walking Dead. But there's toward the end there, you're just like, the payoffs are enormous. And there's a lot of really like solid questions about like morality and humanity and what compassion looks like when things are hard and when is violence justified? I mean, these are huge and important questions. You know, apocalyptic fiction can be one of those places where you can make the questions really clear because the situation can be fraught enough that the choices are harder than they would be. And it makes people say and do things that they wouldn't ordinarily do. You know, I always came back to something that my priest friend told me at one point, where he said, like, you know, like the Greek translation of apocalypse, it has two meanings. That there's, you know, one of it is that it's like things end and things begin again. And the other thing is that it's a moment of understanding. That's baked into when you say revelation, that it's both at the same time, that like this moment when like everything ends and begins again is also the moment where you can like actually understand what the heck is going on.
You know, moment of clarity. I hope you enjoyed this episode. I hope it kept you company while you're busy doing whatever it is you're doing during this strange time. Coming up, I'll have two more socially distanced episodes, one with Amy Hall of Eileen Fisher and one with violin maker Brian Skarstad. If you have a moment, please leave me a positive review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Thank you, and take care.